This is a Senate hearing of the Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs for April 10th, 1977. Hearing Room A, 8 a.m. There will be a hearing on Senate Bill 198, which is on age discrimination in a public accommodation. Senate Bill 228, Administrative Resolutions of Wage Claims, and a work session on B and Gross, Senate Bill 48 on workers' comp.
In order, the first bill we hear this morning is Senate Bill 228. We're privileged to have with us the Honorable James Redden, Attorney General, who will be first. Mary Wendy, do you want her with you? You explain the bill to them, will you?
She's been explaining it to me this morning. The chairman and member of the committee, we were asked during the interim.
You're absolutely right.
By then Governor Straub and encouraged.
Butcher, did you give us your name Governor record? Keel. Otherwise, no one would know.
Jim Redden, Attorney General, to come up with some suggestions on how we could change procedures in the agencies that we represent and the work that we do that would possibly save some money and increase efficiency. This is one of the bills, Senate Bill 228, is an area that we work with the Labor Bureau of Labor and wage claims. By statute, persons with wage claims against their employer may call upon the commissioner of the Bureau of Labor for assistance in collecting wages owed. Under the current statutory scheme, the commissioner is limited to attempting to equitably adjust wage claim controversies between the employer and employee, and if that doesn't work, to file suit against the employer in a court of law. Unlike most agencies, there is no binding administrative process available to the commissioner for administering the laws she is charged with enforcing. This requirement that the commissioner resort to the courts for settlement of wage claim disputes is both costly in time and time-consuming. Presently, the commissioner's wage claim conciliation efforts are unsuccessful in approximately 300 cases per year, and those 300 cases are referred to the Department of Justice to begin court action against the employer. These cases require the time of approximately 3.6 full-time equivalent attorneys each year. When you realize that each attorney plus support staff costs approximately $110,000 each biennium to maintain, it's easy to see that a change in the procedure, which reduces the attorney time required in wage claim matters, will result in substantial savings to the state. In addition, because these cases must take their place on the crowded court dockets and are subject to all of the potential procedural delays associated with court action, final resolution of the claim can take substantial time. We believe Senate Bill 228 represents an alternative to the present wage claim process, which will substantially reduce costs, speed settlements, while continuing to provide an effective method for resolving wage claim complaints. This bill would create an administrative process permitting the commissioner, after a hearing on the complaint, to issue a binding administrative order. These hearings would be conducted as contested cases under the Administrative Procedures Act. As is the case with most such agency hearings, any appeal from the commissioner's order would be to the Court of Appeals. Generally, there would be no need for an attorney to assist the commissioner in these hearings. However, there is a clause in this bill which would allow the employer to insist upon a proceeding in a court of law if the employer so elects. We estimate that this procedure could be used in approximately 60% of the cases which now must be handled through court proceedings. This means that about 180 of the claims which now require handling by the Department of Justice and the courts could be settled administratively by the Bureau of Labor. I want to emphasize that this administrative procedure would supplement rather than replace current means for handling wage claim complaints. The bill has been carefully drawn to protect the rights of both the wage claimant and the employer. The bill will give the commissioner greater flexibility in handling these complaints and result in faster settlement and lower costs. We have some amendments suggested amendments to the bill, which really I don't think are significant in terms of changing the impact of the bill. We have not only the commissioner present today, but individuals from my office who would be glad to go through the bill if you desire, section by section, and explain the bill in technical detail. In essence, what we're doing is substituting an Administrative Procedures Act for the courtroom in some instances in collecting wage claims. As a practical matter, many of these are not contested. They're agreed to, in effect. They're defaulted. We get an administrative order as we do in other areas of the law. We think it would be not only helpful to the commissioner, but would save a considerable amount of time and money for the taxpayers.
Wendy, do you have anything?
I just want to indicate that the Bureau of Labor is in full support of this bill. We have been examining a lot of the old methods of doing things at the Bureau, and particularly examining how we could improve the efficiency and the working relationship between the Bureau of Labor and the Department of Justice. And we are delighted with this bill. We see substantial cost savings to the Bureau of Labor in the future. We anticipate some startup costs, some costs due to slippage in the first year or so, but we think that those costs would be more than offset by the cost savings, even in the first year. I have my staff with me today to answer any questions that you may have about the specific impact of the bill on particular parts of the operation at the Bureau of Labor. One thing that it would eliminate would be the wage assignment part of the current process, which would speed up the process considerably. We think that anything that would reduce our bill to the Attorney General would be more than welcome. In the past, we've experienced considerable delay in the court proceedings, and it's important to us, too, that the bill has been so well drawn that allows the discretion to lie with the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor as to when to utilize the administrative proceedings as opposed to going through the court proceedings on these cases. And I think that's excellent because that can allow us to control costs and to control the phase-in. So I think it's a very well-written bill and we support it.
Chairman. Senator Wingard?
I'm not going to address these questions to either one of you because whoever can answer them is best. Mary, it's good to see you. Jim, I see you all the time. Just tell me what rights the claimant has versus administrative versus present procedure in his determination how he wants to go. Would he in this bill have a choice of how to go, or that it would all be administrative and then he makes an appeal from that point on?
It would be administrative. The employer has an election as to whether to go to court or go through the Administrative Procedures Act. The law does not change the employee's right to proceed independently of the Bureau of Labor, I don't believe. In other words, at the present time, an individual can just get their own lawyer and go to court, or they can elect to proceed through the Bureau of Labor.
Is that?
Yeah. So they both would have a right, really, to proceed through court.
I think it's important to note that there are a lot of default situations in these cases. So in many cases, I think that it wouldn't really make any difference. There isn't that much dispute. It's a question of going through the process.
I find a lot of the employees just insist on, you know, just use the money until an order is entered that they have to pay it. If there's a bankruptcy or a situation like that, it would have to go through the court proceeding.
How long does it generally take to bankrupt the case?
What's the time on bankruptcy? Is there any?
Jeremy, a minimum of 6 months following the filing of the bankruptcy.
help that, that timeframe, doesn't cut down that timeframe.
Would you give your name for the record?
I'm sorry, my name is Victor Levy.
AG's office.
That brings up another point, that's a whole area we ought to look into sometime, is how you allow people in bankruptcy to get their money a little sooner than within about a year. That's another question.
George, if I'm incorrect, don't you have the claimant has a priority on 3 months wages, or is it 3 months wages?
Yes, all wages earned within 90 days of the filing of the bankruptcy are treated as a priority, but then you have to wait the 6 months for the period.
Oh, that's right, of course. Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tungaki.
Jim, when I read this bill, the question I had dealt with the definition of wage claim. And my question to you is that the existing statute speaks only of compensation. And then you've added the phrase, and includes any wages, compensation, damages, or civil penalties provided by law to employees in connection with a claim for unpaid wages. I had always thought that the phrase compensation was limited to the word wages. And I just want to know if, in fact, by adding the other part of the section, and you use wages specifically, that if you're talking about compensation, are you talking about health benefits, some other fringe benefit that the individual's entitled to?
It seems to me that this is
repetitious. Yeah, Vic, go ahead.
This would not include fringe benefits, whether what's considered as part of the wage.
The reason I ask that is because you've separated them in the other, because you speak of wages first, and then you use the word compensation, and I don't know what you mean by compensation if it means wages.
This is the amendment here.
Because it's obvious, it appears to me it would be interpreted to mean something other than wages.
But I think our intention is to keep it limited to the wages.
Okay, that's that right there. So, then you got section four.
Senator, I don't think, and maybe this is confusing, we should take compensation out. It's intended to imply that to apply only to the wages paid, and then the definition of wage claim was expanded.
It covered the guy. There's some of the same
language. Provided by law for not having paid the wages.
Well, it isn't confusing to me. I mean, I'm going to tell you, I would like personally to include that. The problem I'm having, it says wages first, and then you use the word compensation, and surely the word compensation means something, and thus you're telling me that it's synonymous with the word wages. And I don't believe that it is under its normal interpretation, because I think compensation is commonly referred to as that all that is owing to the person, which would include wages, and would include his health and welfare or any other fringe benefit that he was part of his compensation package.
I think you're probably correct, Senator, as a judicial matter, I do not see the normal handle, and I think perhaps specifically the Bureau could amplify on that. But normally we do not include those items if they're been deducted. If someone hasn't been paid, for example, a fringe benefit that should have gone somewhere and was taken out of his paycheck but not repaid, we would include that. Yes, we would consider that an unlawful deduction, and we would attempt to recover that. It's pretty part of wages.
Paul, would you like to comment?
But it would be considered it would be considered wages, not compensation, the fringe benefit.
Yes, I think that's correct.
Well, is this, Mr. Attorney General, is this insurmountable or?
What I'm concerned about is that I would not want the Bureau to put into a position that some claimant contends that he was due $60 on a health and welfare plan, and he got only $50, and then he brings a claim claiming that the employer is required to pay him for that, because I don't recall that you've ever done that before, because you basically just dealt with the wage rate that the guy commonly received. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. We only, I'm Paul Tiffany, Administrator of the Wage and Hour Division. We have only concerned ourselves in the past with wage claims and wage related items. We have not, as Vic amplified earlier, the only time we get into the fringe benefit area is we can identify them with the actual wages paid.
Vic, the other word in there that interests me is the distinction you make between damages or civil penalties. What would you be referring to as damages?
I'm not sure that there's that kind of a distinction there. Each of the statutes provides for a superior type of penalty. And, for example, in the prevailing rate area, there's a double, just double the wage.
What I want to make sure of is that by the word damages, that a claimant doesn't file a claim, and because he said he didn't get his salary, and because of the fact that he didn't have his paycheck, he had to go borrow money, and he suffered damages to the tune of $50 to do it, that's what we're talking about.
Senator Don Arnold from the AG's office, the reason the term damages and civil penalties was used because some of the statutes that provide for penalties use those terms. Some statutes speak in terms of liquidated damages paid to the claimant. Others refer to civil penalties.
So
we just wanted to make it clear that both of those were covered.
Okay. I just want the record clear that you're not talking about any pain and suffering or any out-of-pocket damages at the end. Okay, I understand it.
My question was, Jim, that Section 2 and Section 4 just seems to be a duplication of language. In fact, it starts off the same. Any case where a civil action may be brought under the captain's effective wage claim and Section 4. Will you take a look at it? If you have the amended.
Thank you.
Couldn't Section 4 be eliminated and included in Section 2? Identify yourself for
that. Don Arnold from the AG's office.
Do you see what I mean?
Yes, I do, but there is a reason for the repetition. Section 2 is an amendment to the present statute that is in effect a laundry list of powers of the commissioner in these claims. Section 4 actually sets out the procedure authorized in Section 2.
Amending, in both instances, amending existing law.
Okay.
Are there any further questions by members of the committee? If not, thank you. Do you, Chairman, we could provide the suggested amendments, which aren't included in those that we just provided the administrator with, to clear up the problem that Senator Gonzalez pointed
out. You will provide suggested amendments at a subsequent meeting. You wouldn't have them now.
We'll just send, we don't have them with us, but we'll just send them over.
Work on them now.
Is other than what we have them now? Yeah.
Is there more coming besides these?
No, we provided them with the amendment.
On the one that Lewandowski raised about compensation?
No, but I think that would be a very simple thing. We could just eliminate compensation.
Would that solve your problem?
Mr. Chairman, as I said, that I personally would like, and I'm trying to build a record, I personally like the ability to go after the whole thing. That's my own personal preference. And since I've raised the question, and we understand exactly that there's a distinction between wages and compensation, I personally would just as soon leave it there.
Okay. What do you want to do with the bill? You want to vote on the amendments, or I would?
No, those are the other amendments that the Attorney General brought out.
From the Attorney General's office, right.
And as long as everyone understands that the word compensation is the broadest word, that's the intent of the legislature.
Does that put the definition, does that change the definition for all other purposes? In other words, wage claims have a special significance in the law. They're given precedence over all other claims. Does that now put compensation as other compensation along with wage claims as a preferential item throughout the law?
Not with bankruptcy. If I'm not mistaken, Victor, correct me if I'm wrong, but in bankruptcy proceedings, the priority only exists to wages. It does not extend to fringe benefits like pension funds or health and welfare. I think I'm correct on that, am I not?
There is a provision, Senator, for filing a claim to recover that sum of money. For example, under a collective bargaining agreement, if it has not been paid in, that can be recovered out of a bankruptcy proceeding, assuming that there's money there. A claim may be filed for that.
What could possibly happen, the worst happen, as far as the employer is concerned, by leaving the word compensation in there? Is the workman going to be able to collect something other than his wages? Is that so broad that he can collect something other than his wages? Or are we nitpicking?
Well, I think it's the broadest thing that could be encompassed within the wages. It would cover,
the broadest.
Being clear. Sometimes we have cases, for example, and I'm not really sure how the Bureau handles it, but sometimes someone is told that we get $5 an hour plus 4 cents a mile. And I think, for example, that the 4 cents a mile, if that is part and parcel of the agreement, I think that might be an includable item that would come in there. But it clearly would not be compensation in the sense that I lost my car and I now owe, I've lost $2,000 by virtue of having my car repossessed. I don't believe that we understand the term that way.
Dan, are you?
Oh, no, Mr. Chairman, I think that Mr. Levy has said what I want the broadest definition to mean. That's fine with me. I just going to leave it there.
Okay, do I have a motion for adoption amendment?
Is there anyone else? No one's going to testify against this?
Nope.
No.
Fine, Mr. Chairman, I'd move it out.
We adopt the amendment. Are there any objections?
Which is this? That's right. That's engrossed with the amendment. In other words, these amendments have been engrossed in the bill.
Don, you run through the amendment.
Chairman, I just didn't let this bill sit for a day before I vote on it.
Okay. We'll take this bill up at our next meeting. If there's any problems that you may have, why can talk to Jim Redden or Wendy. Let's go to Senate Bill 198. We'll entertain a motion to take Senate Bill 198 off the table.
I so move, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Krulgosch moves Senate
Bill 198 be taken from the table. Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Hannan?
Aye.
Senator Trow?
Aye.
Senator Wingard?
Aye.
Senator Kulongowski? Senator Gardner?
Aye. Senator Kulongowski, how do you vote? Okay. Senate Bill 198 is off the table. Robert Steen with the Bureau of Labor. And Commissioner Roberts.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, Senate Bill 198 attempts to remedy an existing inconsistency within portions of the law under the jurisdiction of the Bureau of Labor. In 1977, the legislature amended ORS 659037 to prohibit any notice by a place of public accommodations that advantages, services, or privileges would be denied to an individual because of age, where the individual is 18 years of age or older. Two exceptions were provided in the statute. One, minors would not be allowed in places of public accommodations offering the sale of alcoholic beverages. And two, special rates would be offered to persons 55 years of age and older. Also amended was ORS 659045 so that it permits an individual to file a complaint with the Bureau of Labor on the basis of age if the individual, again, is 18 years of age or older for any alleged discrimination made by public accommodation as defined under ORS 30.675. However, the Public Accommodations Act, ORS 30.670 to 30.685 itself was not amended to reflect this change. Senate Bill 198 seeks to amend ORS 30.675 to make it unlawful for a place of public accommodation to discriminate against an individual because of age, where the individual is 18 years or older. The two exceptions provided in ORS 659037 should also be provided in a proposed amendment to ORS 30.675 to leave no doubt that the legislature does not intend to require minors to be served liquor and to ensure that businesses may provide special rates to individuals 55 years of age and older, many of whom are forced to live on fixed incomes. I have provided you with a copy of amendment to...
Let me ask you this, Bob. What are the problems? Are there problems where people are being denied lodging that want to rent a motel? Or is this what it would apply to as well as a home?
The basic problem that we are attempting to correct was that under the public accommodations section, the age was not included. It is listed in other parts of the civil rights statute, but which does refer to age, but it was not included in public accommodations.
So in public accommodations, an 18-year-old could get a room.
Right. The Oregon law now recognizes 18 years, a person's 18 years and older as mature adults. That's already established in statute.
What about renting a home? An 18-year-old comes to me and wants to rent a home, and I would deny him the rental of that house. Would I be subject to action by the Bureau of Labor?
Yes, under the amendments that we are introducing today,
this disturbs me because there's some 18-year-olds I wouldn't want to rent my place to. And I've had problems, and I think the landlord has had problems in renting to young people who even the neighbors complain. So if I were to refuse him, then I would be subject to action by the Bureau of Labor.
Chairman?
I think the landlord needs some protection, too.
Chairman?
Yes, Senator Roberts.
Well, as not only as the Commissioner of Labor, but also as a landlady myself, I can assure you that abuse of landlords and landladies is not unique to the 18-year-olds. It could be any age. And I think that the problem that this bill is attempting to address is twofold. One, of course, is just simply the correction of what appeared to be an oversight in the original amending of the statute to provide for protection against discrimination on the basis of age, because we do actually have it. It's not very clear in statute. But the second thing is to attempt to address the problem of individuals being discriminated against on the basis of an arbitrary characteristic rather than treated as individuals on the basis of their own references, their own behavior. And in this case, I suspect that the group that has experienced the most discrimination has not necessarily been the 18-year-old. It's been simply an arbitrary discrimination that's been practiced against people in various groups, depending on the particular attitude of the individual who discriminates. An individual who might, in a motel or hotel, might discriminate against a young person. A person in a restaurant serving individuals in a restaurant might decide that they want to encourage a particular age group there and discourage another particular age group. They could.
And I might decide that that there's a young person, 18, 19 years of age, that wants to rent my house. And I feel, from just observing or looking at this person, that it might be just one continuous party, and the neighbors are going to call me and complain. And if I were to refuse him, then he'd go to you. I don't know this, but just the only way I can just have observed from my first meeting with that person, and then I'm in trouble. What kind of action would you take against me if I were to turn this person down? What would it cost me?
Well, I think that the important thing is you would have to, there would have to be a complaint filed in a case of such as you outlined, and there would have to be proof that the discrimination occurred not on the basis of your evaluation of that individual's particular potential as a good, say, a good tenant or a good, a reasonable risk, but solely on the basis of an arbitrary characteristic such as age. It's important to have a lower age limit in the statute, because without it, this bill would apply to individuals lower than 18 as well.
How many public accommodations violations or complaints were filed last year?
I do have that information with me.
Bob, would you know
check
that?
The percentage, the largest percentage has always been employment. Public accommodation has been...
Is this a real problem?
It has not been a major problem, but it's a problem for those individuals that experience that discrimination.
Does this mean that, for example, an 18-year-old wanted to move into a senior housing project, would we be able to?
We specifically addressed that in the amendments to prevent that kind of problem. Right now, that has been the area that people have expressed the most concern about, and we have specifically exempted such situations in our amendments to the 2198.
Any questions by the members of the
committee?
You can understand our concern.
Mr. Chairman, I would suspect that I don't have the statistics on the age breakdown of age discrimination cases, but I think it's important that we see the bill as addressing concerns that elderly have had as well. And I think that it's important that there be a very clear message in statute, a clear definition of what age group we're referring to, and we have specifically...
The landlord has been harassed. It seems like the tenant is wise to the laws, and I think he's being harassed. I have never had any problem, but I know those that do. And
the current law does...
18-year-old, I would question renting a house. I would certainly would be reluctant to rent my home or one of my rentals to an 18-year-old. Unless he's come well recommended, and I knew that boy for a period of years, knew he would make a good tenant.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I certainly respect your concerns, but I think it's important to recognize that the statute is attempting to simply deal with discrimination that occurs on the basis of an arbitrary characteristic that is not justifiable on the basis of that individual's merit. I'm sure that you have had experience with young people, your own family, for example, that you would certainly not hesitate to rent to, or to, if you were an individual who was providing a service to the public classified under the law as a public accommodation, that you would not hesitate to serve those young people in your establishment. I think that the law recognizes... Well, maybe not all of your relatives, Chairman, but certainly I think that the kind of discrimination based on judgment of that individual's capability of conducting themselves well in that situation is allowed. What is not allowed is an arbitrary discrimination solely on age.
Additionally, Mr. Chairman, ORS 190.510 does provide that an 18-year-old reaches majority and is able to conduct his or her own business at the age of 18. So that
they can enter into a contract, in short. And the reason that it's important to recognize 18 as the
I wouldn't deny anybody on the age.
Pardon?
But our national origin, I think the question is that they're just turning an 18-year-old down or a 19-year-old.
Mr. Chairman.
He's never rented property before, and you wouldn't know.
Well, I think
get,
that
once
if
they get in, it's difficult to have them removed.
I think it's important to recognize that 18-year-olds have been accorded other rights under law as adults. They can vote. They can do a lot of other things. And I think that it's important to say that if they are treated as adults in other respects, and that there is no arbitrary distinction made in the law in most areas for any differential treatment or civil rights between an 18-year-old and a 21-year-old, with a possible exception drinking of liquor, that it's certainly appropriate to have them covered by the civil rights statute in terms of age discrimination if you're going to cover it, say, a 21-year-old.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, Bob, and thank you, Wendy.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, did you want us to go through any of the amendments?
Oh, yes, that's right. You have the amendments. We have copies of them.
Yes.
Yeah. And you have the engrossed version.
No, they have more.
Oh, they have more? Oh.
Do we have the engrossed version?
Yeah, but they have more.
There's more than
on page 2 of the printed bill. line 3, after or at 659.010, we are inserting 659.033 and 659.037. On line 17, we are changing his and her terms, and after talking with legislative council, we're going back to more of the neutral gender term. Line 26 is a continuation of that. Line 22 on page 3 is also a continuation of general term. In line 30, we are deleting, again, a gender term, same with line 31. We are deleting line 31, she, and then inserting the attorney general or the commissioner. In line 32, we are also deleting a his or hers. On page 4, line 3 starts the most substantive change for the bill. After, we are deleting the word minor, this is line 3, deleting the word minor and inserting the statement, persons under 21 years of age. And then in the same line, we are deleting the second minor of minors and inserting by persons of 21 years of age. In line 4, we are deleting the final period and inserting the statement and the exception for special rates of services offered to persons 55 years of age or older and older. After line 21, we are amending in section 6, ORS 659.33, and we are amending it to read as you have it there on your sheets. Would you like me to read through that?
What was that, Bob?
We are amending in this, a whole new section.
Yep. No, we can read it. If you want to explain it or have any explanation of this new section, why, please go ahead.
Okay, well, I'll just respond to any questions that you may have. And additionally, we are amending in ORS 659.037 with the amendments that you have in front of you there.
Is that, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Wingard.
Has the age discrimination section as written? Does that work both ways? Keep the elderly out of the swinging singles project?
No, we are, Senator Wingard, we are saying that the only exception that we are making in the housing is that we are identifying retirement centers and limiting the access to those areas just to persons 55 years of age and older. All other accommodations would be open to the public.
I don't know how those work, but my understanding, there are a lot of apartment projects in Portland that have only young people in them. And, I was just wondering, the way the bill is written, that if you were, well, if you were older, thought you might want to live in one of those places, there'd be nothing.
Would
it both ways?
Mr. Chairman, the current law prohibits discrimination in housing and also discrimination in public accommodation on the basis of marital status. In terms of the discrimination that you're referring to, I suspect that discrimination is not an act of discrimination on the part of the individual renting those apartments, but is what naturally occurs when people are seeking a an apartment situation that is suitable to their socializing, and I would assume that that would.
Mary, is that section of law in this bill relating to marital status?
No.
No, but I mean.
Oh, you mean in the
statutory reference in here that would I could read. Oh, I see it.
I do have the percentages, Mr. Chairman, if you wanted them on the
you have what?
On the cases that were filed in 1978, the percentage that related to public accommodations.
Yes,
you want that?
How many cases do you have?
There were a total of 36 cases filed in 1978. That was only 4% of the total that were filed. Housing, however, there were an additional 43%, or 43 cases that were filed in housing, so the another 4% approximately.
Bob Rich has a
question. Mr. Steen, we were supplied with this engrossed version that says amended with legal legislative council amendments 3779. Does this include everything that's in the amendments with the exception of section 7, which is also separate here?
I'm not familiar with that copy that you have.
I see.
I didn't give that to you.
This appears to have everything that goes through Section 6, and then in the separate amendments, there's a Section 7 which deals with ORS 659037.
Okay, 659037 is an additional. Do you have 659033 on that topic?
Yes, that is in here.
Okay, fine.
Chairman?
Senator Kulongoski.
George, let me ask you a question because you're more familiar with this. With the amendment on line 21, it says no, and you add A.
What page are you on?
I'm on the amendments. Just pick up the amendments. And just look at after line 21, insert. It says no person shall, because of race, color, sex, marital status, religion, or national origin, or age, if the individual is 18 years of old, age or older, of any person, refuse to sell, lease, or rent any real property to a purchaser. The question I have of you, that it appears to me that in selling property or renting property and you establish a rental rate, that it's related to the individual's ability to pay. And an individual's ability to pay is related in some ways to the age on their ability to have a job, you know, I mean, or obtain income. And would that, in essence, by the addition of that, be saying that you could not, if you determine that an individual, let's say an older person, does not have the economic security because he doesn't have the job to pay the land sale contract, let's assume that you could not refuse to sell it to him on that basis? And let me go one step further. What about a rental agreement with some young people that want to rent your place? And if, in fact, that you determine, you ask him what he does, and you, for some reason, don't believe that he's economically stable enough to be able to pay it, that you could not refuse to rent it to him?
I don't know, so maybe somebody from a savings loan that gives loans would better answer that question.
Would you have the right, though, as a landlord, to ask him what his earnings, a financial statement, what his earnings are, and where he works, and all of this information, so before you? I know that I think most landlords do if they.
Well, it is interesting when you get down to see, when you evaluate that modifier.
It's obvious that wasn't the intent, but it's obvious to me that in the selling of property, if you take a land sale contract, you're concerned about the financial.
Especially when it's specific in the law, that's specific.
That's the one that I find interesting under that situation.
Well, you find it interesting because you're an attorney, and it'd be the first thing you'd look for. You know, a little crack to get in there and pry it open.
Judge, what I'm trying to do is to not have someone file a lawsuit under that.
But we just got to get away from that kind of thing.
I realize.
If you just eliminate you guys, the problem would be half solved.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I think that it's the statistics that I mentioned to you indicate that the problem that that might be anticipated here has not surfaced as a major problem in terms of discrimination in public accommodations or housing on the basis of the other protected class statuses that currently exist. It's not a major area of discrimination, but it does exist. It has existed on the basis of race and color. It has on the basis of marital status. It has on the basis of physical or mental handicap. And it exists now on the basis of age. And I think that for those individuals that are affected, there should be remedy.
But
and that's
I would tell you that just looking at race, color, sex, marital status, religion, or national origin, what they're not related to is the person's ability to produce income.
That's not true.
On discrimination.
Individuals who are on welfare, whose marital status is separated, divorced, and who have a number of children, it is very much related to their income.
And that's why that was put in the law. But the fact is that age is directly related to an individual's ability under real property to buy a piece of property, because he may be such an age that he's out of the job market, or he may be too young.
Yes,
and
it's true.
And the question is whether, in fact, by C, is that you could tell the person, and I'm not, interesting
mm-hmm.
enough, it's not the older person. I think it's the younger one. It's your 18. Okay, but you get to the point and just say, listen, you've got this job, but I just don't think you have the financial resource because you haven't worked long enough. You're a young guy coming up to be able to afford this.
It's also true on the basis of an individual who is living on Social Security or a very small pension. The fact is that this law does not require a landlord or anyone to subsidize an individual simply because they are an age group and a circumstance that makes them financially less of a risk. What it does do is say that simply on that characteristic of age, you cannot discriminate. You can discriminate on the basis of financial ability to meet the obligations that you are considering entering into with this individual. And the law is, I think, is clear on that.
I think that it would be the bank would make that determination, or the financial institution, wherever the loan is made, would make the determination whether or not that the person, regardless of age, is financially capable of making the payments on his house, or maybe or the property, or maybe his heirs. Would solve the situation rather than the real estate. The realtor could sell a property to a man 70 years of age, so the bank won't loan the money. Obviously, he's not going to get it. If he doesn't have it, he's not going to get the property.
There have been instances of individuals who have been discriminated against in housing on the basis of the fact that the landlord is concerned about the individual's health. And that may be also related to that individual's concept of age as it relates to health. Just an emotional response to seeing an individual who is elderly, who's looking for an apartment, fear about that individual perhaps dying in that person's apartment, that kind of thing, and thereby discriminating against that individual and just saying, look, I don't want you people here in my apartment because I don't want to have to deal with any problems. You understand? That's the kind of discrimination that can occur. There can also be discrimination that occurs on the basis of stereotypes, an idea that all young people are irresponsible and all old people are a problem to have around. And this is the kind of stereotyping, this kind of response to individuals based on prejudice against a group that the law is attempting to eliminate.
All
Are there any further questions? If not, George, you're probably have greater expertise in this than anyone that I know of.
Don't dump this one on me.
In the Oregon legislature.
Mr. Chairman, I understand Senator Wingard's position. I would be more than happy if you want to work.
I think that if you could work with the with some of the financial institutions and see how they'd handle it, there are in need of amendments in
the
here.
Last time this happened to me, very mysteriously, the tapes were missing. And I appreciate your concern about having somebody know
in this
what
committee?
Talking about.
The tapes
no. No, it was in another committee.
Well,
the revenue committee.
That happened here.
And I refused to Senator Bowe, when he'd taken over the revenue committee from Senator Cook, to work out the homeowner rented or property tax relief portion of the tax plan. And in that refusal, I said so on the tapes because I had a conflict of interest. And then he said, well, I want you to take it anyway on the basis that you have some knowledge. So I took it, and then in the next campaign, I was running against a gentleman who brought up this fact. And then so I went to get the tapes, which I said would show clearly that I refused to take this committee. The tapes were missing. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to refuse so that we won't have to worry about the tapes being missing and any possible problems in the future.
Joanne and Melanor. The custodians of the tapes, and I'm sure that they will be there. In fact, in
no, the archivist was in possession of the tapes.
Oh, well, I mean during the session. I'll ask Senator Kulikowski if he would in contact the see if they, you might have some of the financial institutions take a look at it.
Let him form a subcommittee.
What's that?
Let him work as a subcommittee.
Right, at what? Fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we'd like to do a little work on Senate Bill 48, and if the
thank
experts
you,
can come forward. Where's Roy? Green. Senator Kulikowski, would you take over for a minute? I've got to go over. I'll be gone just a few minutes.
Sure, Mr. Chairman.
And what we'd like to do is take a look at 48.
While you're gone, did you want to play it on the table?
I don't care what you do.
Okay.
But I might prefer it would pass.
Everybody go through the bill book and pick out a bill you want.
Where do you want to
lay it on the table?
What is that list for those of you who asked about?
I'm willing to accommodate any of my colleagues.
What are we supposed to be doing?
48.
Is this on the agenda, Judge? Well, is this on the agenda?
48.
Well, if you've got this amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I've got this amendment.
Where's the amendment?
Also, Mr. Chairman, we should discuss the psychologist section, I think.
Let's get on that first.
We instead of agreed that we would re-include psychologists.
Dr. Crothers?
Why don't you come on up? You were the one that they talked about yesterday. members of the committee, it's Senate B. Engrossed version, Senate Bill 48, page 17, lines 1 and 2. For refreshing your memory, you recall that the psychologist came in and stated that the current law would delete them, I mean the proposed amendment would delete psychologists from the definition of doctor or physician. And how that's done is the addition of the phrase, under the present law, as I understand it, the board has an administrative rule that allows psychologists to treat these people. Under the new addition, that's the new language as defined in sections 1 to 7 of ORS 676.110, that specifically does not include psychologists at all. And Dr. Crothers was the one that was identified at the last meeting as the sponsor of this amendment, and the chairman wanted him to come here and explain his rationale.
The chairman wanted him to do it again. It was certainly not the intent to exclude psychologists from their services in the system. The issue isn't really, in my view, a terribly important one. It's a matter of confusion more than anything else. The statutes refer repeatedly to the attending physician and in one place to the treating physician. And the attending physician has certain duties under the statute, which are to make the physician's first report of an injury and to say that the person is medically stationary and to prescribe certain kinds of treatment that the person must follow. I never knew, as I said at the meeting before, I never knew of a psychologist who referred to himself as an attending physician. There was one case that I know of where a psychologist asked for the reopening of a closed claim, and this was granted, and he continued to treat this person for about a year and used the phrase that the man was medically stationary, but he wasn't psychologically stationary. And, we didn't know where we were. I don't know. The phrase has no psychologically stationary, has no legal meaning. I don't believe that psychologist is in a position to say that a person is medically stationary. As I say, it's largely a matter of confusion in meaning in the statutes. And I haven't been able to come up, nor with Cliff Allison, haven't been able to come up with any language that clarifies it in the direction that we wanted to do, which was not to exclude the psychologists from their proper role in the system.
Chairman? Yes, Senator Wingard.
Is it your recommendation that we just eliminate that?
I would be content just to eliminate that section at the present time.
Senator Wingard has moved that on page 17, line 2, the bold-typed material as defined in subsections 1 to 7 of ORS 676.110 be deleted from the bill. Does everyone understand the amendment? Now, what the effect of that is it just in essence reinstates the existing statutory definition of doctor or physician. Cliff, that's right, isn't it? That just reinstates the existing statutory definition of doctor or physician. Okay. Is there any further discussion of the amendment? Senator Troll.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I presume that this applies only in this instance, the definition of doctor or physician, since psychologists do have most of them have PhDs, doctors of philosophy. PhD is an older degree than the MD, a very acceptable, respectable degree. I have one. I like it a lot. I don't want a definition of doctor so narrowly circumscribed as this definition, unless it applies only in this narrow instance.
Okay. Cliff, let me do this. Why don't we act on the motion and to take out the... And
why don't
go
we
back
just take out the whole phrase, the whole number 15?
Well, we can't do that, and I'll explain why, but just to get us back to the existing law, and let's do it that way. Is that okay? And then we'll work from the existing statute rather than having to deal with as defined in that such and such. Do you know what I mean? I'm not making myself clear. I understand.
In other words, you'd like to go ahead and work, operate on that motion. Did we do?
Yes, and delete that first.
Fine.
And then work on the existing statute.
Yes, all right.
Is there any further discussion of the amendment?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Hannon.
I would still like to know the definition that's laid out here. That's the one that pertains strictly to the healing arts.
That's the definition.
That you want to remove?
No. If you look on line 17, the definition on line 1 and 2, absent the bold type, is the existing statutory definition which they presently have.
Do we have a copy of that definition?
Yes, that's right.
Let's see what...
Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection to the amendment? Hearing none, so adopted. Now, Cliff, could you come up here a second? I just called Cliff Allison up, and you've heard the question that Senator Troll has asked about the definition of doctor or physician. I want to ask you a couple questions first. Under the current law, is psychologist included within the doctor in the definition in the existing law of doctor or physician?
Yes.
And is that done by the statute or is it done by administrative rule?
I think it's done by the interpretation of the statute.
I don't think
yeah.
Cliff,
I just don't like this.
Yeah. He's going to answer your question. How psychologists are in that definition?
Okay. Yeah. That's not my question exactly. But go ahead. Tell me that.
All right. In July of 1977, Forrest James, who was one of the referees, issued a memorandum regarding psychologists as doctors, as physicians, as defined by ORS 656.00513. In 1973, there were certain legislative changes in ORS Chapter 675. For example, before 1973, 675.0144, practice of psychologist definition did not include diagnosis. In 73, there was an amendment to this, practice of psychology, and includes but is not limited to the diagnosis, prevention, treatment, and amelioration of psychological problems and emotional and mental disorders of individuals and groups. Also in 1973, ORS 675.0610 sub 1 provided a certified psychologist engaging in psychotherapy with clients in order to make provisions for the diagnosis and treatment of medical problems shall generally collaborate in each instance with a physician licensed to practice medicine under the laws of the state. Okay, that section was repealed by the 1973 legislation. And then there were some other exceptions. So what the board has stated, in effect, when there was a Walter P. Williams case that came down involving Dr. Hickman, and I asked the board for a clarification of what they meant by classifying Dr. Hickman as, quote, a doctor, a psychologist as a doctor within the meaning of this section, and whether or not they considered this him as a treating physician, treating doctor. This is where the problem came up. Their response to me is the fact that so far the board does not attempt to tell anyone that a psychologist is a treating physician. However, psychologists are included within the definition of doctor or physician as defined in ORS 656.0513, which is the present law. If I may, here's the problem that we have with psychologists in per se, say, with this definition by the board, the ruling of the board.
6562452 says, the worker may choose his own attending doctor or physician. Now, my understanding from the testimony and everything here and the psychologists themselves, we agree that, quote, the psychologist does not open or close a claim. Well, under 245, that's for further medical concern. Are we concerned, does that include a psychologist? 248 says medical services rate. Does that include a psychologist? 252 concerns rules and regulations governing reports of attending and examining physicians. The statute goes through attending and examining physicians. The statute uses attending doctors. Report on 2652, report or statement secured from a worker or from his doctor and signed by the worker constitutes a claim. We're saying this does not include psychologists. That's what we've been trying to say. This does not include. 273, a physician's report indicating need for further medical services. You're talking about medical services. We're saying under 273, a psychologist doesn't open a claim. He doesn't. His report doesn't dignify an aggravation of a claim. And then they go in and adequacy of physician report is not jurisdictional. 310 has a doctor rendering medical and surgical reports. We say this should not include psychologists. The injured worker under 325 has failed to follow medical advice from his treating physician. We're saying psychologists are not treating physicians. Then on 7942B, we say reports here do include psychologists. 656806 has to do with pre-employment medical examination. This does not include psychologists. What we were trying to do is clarify, especially the areas of opening and closing claims, did not include psychologists.
Okay, so we all understand what the board has done. The board has recognized that psychologists play an extremely important role in treating injured workers. To allow them to be paid and have the claimant go to them and avail themselves of their service, the board had to find them within the definition of doctor or physician in the statute. But at the same time that the board was given recognition to that situation, it was also recognizing that under the statute, as far as opening a claim and falling into what they call the attending physician, to be able to open a claim, to declare the individual medically stationary, and to open an aggravation claim, they were not doctors or physician under the statute.
That's correct.
So they were trying to go both ways with it, and what you were attempting to do was to send it down one way and just say, in the definition of doctors or physician, it would not include psychologists. But the problem with that, as I understand it, they would no longer be able to have their services available to these people to be paid.
We didn't feel that when we wrote that amendment to the law that would affect the psychologist one way or the other. It would just clarify these issues throughout the statute where we were talking.
It's obvious that they thought that they were being excluded, because I know all
that's
of
right, and it's obvious they thought that they were being excluded, but that was certainly not the intent. The intent was that to make sure that we're, one of the problems we had on our closure, 268, and it had to deal again with Dr. Hitler, is that he said, I am the treating, quote, physician, and you cannot close a claim based on he's not psychologically stationary. Well, my response to that was to the evaluation. If the medical reports that you have from the physicians, doctors, and so forth are considered, and they indicate that the individual is, quote, medically stationary, you close him regardless of what the psychologist says.
Okay, that's the point that I want to make, and I want the record to show that, Cliff, is that...
For certain purposes, the psychologists are not, quote, attending,
okay,
examining physicians.
And
Mr. Chairman,
yes,
yeah.
Senator
well, the point I think I'm trying to make is the fact that you use two words, doctor or physician. Psychologists, many of them are doctors because they possess the degree
that's
that
right.
Entitles themselves to call themselves a doctor. If you just said physician, I think, rather than doctors or, and then try to describe in the law a situation where they're not doctors, even though they have the degree and they are a doctor, I think it just doesn't make sense. So if you'd say physician means a person, I think you'd be better off than if you just doctor or physician. But
I don't care. I mean, all you're doing is describing it within the framework of this body of statute.
No,
But it's just it's an annoyance.
Cliff,
because the medical profession has tried to dominate the word doctor, and lots of other people are entitled to use it and do use it.
And I would suggest to you, if you take the word doctor out of there and you use physicians, you're not only going to have the psychologist in here, you're going to have the optometrist, you're going to have every single person that is not a physician, as it's defined on the statute in here, claiming exactly what the psychologist did, that they're all being excluded. Now, whether we're doing that or not, it's the appearance of it that they're going to...
Well, I think with the amendment, we really haven't excluded anybody, have we? So I just leave...
That's the existing law, and what we're basically saying, do it the way we've always done it. What I want to make sure of, Cliff, that in this whole transaction, that it's not my intent to have psychologists be able to close a claim or declare the individual medically stationary. After talking to them, they don't believe that they should have that authority or responsibility. And it's in the treatment of the individual that they're concerned that they remain a viable part of the workers' compensation system. And that it is not our intent to have a claim remain open because the person is not psychologically stationary, even though a physician has determined that he is medically stationary.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If that's not adequately spelled out in the administrative rules, then maybe it ought to be adequately spelled out in the statutes rather than just your and his understanding of what it means.
What I'm trying to do is to say that we're back at the same spot we were before Dr. Crothers ever proposed the amendment.
Right. Right. And back to my interpretation that psychologist does not apply for 245, some of these sections that I read out. They're not the attending physician, they're not the attending doctor, they're not the treating doctor for purpose of closure or opening claim.
Okay. Is that spelled out any place?
No.
No, it's not. So it's just it's a matter of dispute now.
Well, I think reading each particular ORS, it's a valid interpretation. I think we can sustain the interpretation.
But you might be subject to litigation or some other problem. Why don't you spell it out in the statute so you know what you're talking about?
We're talking about, the difficulty. I'm having real difficulty.
What the basic problem is, Cliff, is that every time the session meets, we add some new section to the statute, and we always are not very diligent in trying to conform them to the existing definitions. And what I think Cliff's problem is if we did that, we're going to have a major review and a major amendment to the law because you'd have to conform them all. And what Cliff, I think, was saying is, why don't you adopt an administrative rule defining this? That's it.
I don't think so, if it would stand up.
But I don't want you to...
But what I'm also saying is that if it's necessary, let's do it by statute and get it done adequately. Okay. Maybe not this time, but sometime.
Okay. Well, the other amendment that was proposed is that you have it here from Dr. Crothers, and it says that it's on page 2, line 13. Okay. Sub 2 would remain intact, and the new sentence is added to the end of that that says the director shall establish such criteria for the enforcement of medical reporting requirements, including forfeitures of fees and civil penalties not to exceed $500. Dr. Crothers, you are identified as the maker of this amendment.
The committee had seemed eager to add penalty in addition to those that we have. The position of the OMA is we don't need any more than we have now. We can have some fairly stringent ones, including complete forfeiture of fees that have been paid. As I told you before, the state of Washington has a statutory fine of $100, which they told me they had never
used, although they indicated they thought it was useful to have that threat there. And since you did want something, I suggested this place to put it, just add it on to the sanction section that's already in the statute.
Maury, just after reading it, and I don't think it, I haven't, I know what you're intending to do, but it appears that that isn't the place it's supposed to go. Because that section 2 is talking about non-complying employers. And
well, he's taken the wrong section of the statute and added it.
I'm just looking at the bill, and it says page 2, line 13.
That's what it says.
My suggestion.
Oh, it's the wrong page. I'm sorry, Maury. Hold it just a second. Maury?
Yeah.
The staff said that it's the wrong page that he picked, and so we've got to find it.
What page is it? If I may, ORS 656.745 in the statute has to do with penalties as far as insurers and so forth. And if you look at Senate Bill 379 in growth that you have in, before you, there is a section 2 in that bill having to do with penalties of provisions and so forth.
My suggestion was that rather than what you had there, and perhaps I didn't make my suggestion in the proper form because I wasn't looking at the gross bill. My suggestion
Dr.
was...
Dr. Crothers,
yes.
Just a second. Cliff, are you saying that this amendment isn't the 48 at all?
Well, I don't have the amendment that's passing.
We're amending the wrong bill.
Well, he said this is not it. This section.
Was the section it was in that's been reincorporated into this bill.
All I'm saying is Senate Bill 379A in growth.
I don't want to talk about 379 right now.
Has a penalty.
I will get to that.
Okay.
What bill are we amending?
Okay. This amendment that I just talked about is not the Senate Bill 48 because it's been taken out of 48 and put in another bill. Now, the only problem I have is the chairman told everybody to show up, talk about Senate Bill 48, and he didn't tell them to show up to talk about any other bill. And there's no notice to anyone that we're going to work on another bill.
Yes, sir.
Is there?
It basically said
a notice that we'll work on anything. Almost dealing with workers' comp.
What? Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. He's got it covering everything, so let's go look at 379. I'm sorry that he didn't tell me.
Why don't we amend this into 48? Get that fun with it.
Can't find out where it goes in 379, Cliff.
Okay, section 2. Page 2, section 2.
Okay, everybody, it's on, take A and Grove Senate Bill 379, page 2, line 39, section 2, or 656-745. Okay, Mark, where do you want to put that now?
Senator, I think the most appropriate place, if you want an additional sanction against physicians for failure to make medical reporting, to meet the medical reporting requirements, I believe that the place to put it is in ORS 656.254, sub 2, which says, the director shall establish sanctions for the enforcement of medical reporting requirements, to which I would add, including forfeiture of fees and civil penalties and or civil penalties not to exceed $500.
Is that on page 3 of sub 2?
No. I'm gonna tell you, just a second now. So everyone understands this. I finally figured it out. Cliff is talking about amending one particular statute, and Dr. Crothers is talking about amending another statute. Dr. Crothers' statute that he wants to amend is in Senate Bill 48. Cliff's amendment that he wants to amend is in 379.
Well, I was merely asked to come up with some language about additional penalties on physicians, which I have. You've got so damn many bills around here that
I agree with you.
I don't know which one you're talking about.
And since no one told any of us what we're supposed
to. It doesn't go in the non-compliant area, though, Senator.
It should not be in 254, is what you're telling me.
In 054.
Okay.
I think it should be in 254.
Mm-hmm. 254 is not in Senate Bill 48B.
Is it in any bill?
Not to my knowledge.
Why don't we leave this amendment alone?
Yeah, I've got it. That's a good idea.
That will please the OMA if you just leave it out entirely.
What do you want
to do? What time is session?
No, it's just that it's obvious that the chairman had something scheduled and had a program, and we were never informed of what it was. He left the door.
Is he out there?
Okay. Does anyone have any further amendments at this particular time to Senate Bill 48? Now. Oh, I'm just asking anybody. Here's the thing. The chairman obviously wants to move this bill out. I am not inclined to do that until
we have more of a committee here.
That's right.
Be that.
That's exactly.
I wanted to talk about the rating system again, Mr. Chairman. I remember a testimony the other night on page 12, lines 32 through 36. There was a good deal of discussion on the rating system, and I'm not clear in my mind what this particular new section would do. Now, the criticism of this section was that we would take out the human element and of rating, and then it becomes very arbitrary. And I'm wondering, is there anybody that could comment on that, or is anybody on the committee? Are you familiar with that?
Let me, if I could.
If I could use the blackboard and flip you correctly when I'm wrong. This is on the rating system. Tell them what the problem is, what the purpose of the statute is.
The amended section.
The amended section.
Yeah.
At the present time, if you look at my check, if this is closing an evaluation, and what happens is when causing an evaluation gets a statement from the treating physician that the individual claimant is medically stationary, they make a decision upon whether that the degree of disability that that individual has incurred because of that injury. That what they do is they have a rating system. Now, I think that the closing and evaluation, and the point to remember, George, is this closing and evaluation is under the director of workers' comp. That's Mr. Green's position.
That's now.
And what they do is they determine the degree of disability and put, if any, and put that in a determination order and put it out. The individual, within 1 year after the determination order is issued, can appeal that decision to the closing evaluation, to the hearing. The hearing division is under the board. If you will look at the top of that page, on that bill, on lines 8 and 9, that gives the board the current authority to say providing general guidelines for the evaluation of permanent disabilities, reevaluating permanent total disability awards, which is under the board in the hearing division. The argument is that they are not using the same rating standard that closing the evaluation is using. They back that up by this statistic that approximately 80% of all the claims that are appealed from a determination order that go to hearing, that 80% of those cases result in a higher award. As an example, if there were 10,000 cases heard, as an example, just hypothetical figures, that 8,000 of them, the claimant receives a higher award. The argument is that creates a statistical advantage, so why would you ever accept the award to close C&E? But there are a number of reasons why I think that the, and a number of people think that that award 80% figure. One is the fact that that bill's 48 attempts to take care of is that the board, the workers' comp board, has said that, let's say they, in an example, the determination order comes out on May 1 of this year, that individual has a year to appeal it. And he may, let's say, appeals it on December 1, 1979, and the hearing isn't set for 2 or 3 months, and it's heard in February of 80, that over almost a year has gone by since the original determination order was issued. There may be subsequent medical, but the fact is that because the claimant has asked for a hearing, closing evaluation no longer has any jurisdiction over the case. That bill, one of the Senate Bill 48, one of the attempts to do is to require the claimant to file a reconsideration and submit subsequent medicals prior to going to hearing. One of the ways, that's one issue, and then the other way, with the section charge you're talking about, which they intend to try to correct, is have the directors established by administrative rule, a rating standard for disability that would be applicable both to closing the evaluation and the hearing.
You started to tell me, Mr. Chairman, why there was a difference in many of these cases, and then I never did get the difference. You started to tell me that because of time, but I didn't understand.
Because of the fact that they make the decision on May 1, you know, closing evaluation, and a year may pass before it actually gets to hearing what he's appealing. And the problem is that the claimant may have had a subsequent medical, he may have done a variety of things, which closing an evaluation has never been, had the opportunity to look at to issue a new determination order to say, yes, we agree with you, that there is a greater extent of disability. That's one of the issues. But the primary section you're talking about, George, is it attempts to establish by administrative rule a rating standard of disability that would be applicable both to C&E and the hearing. And understand the bill in a later section allows C&E to get all subsequent medicals prior to going to hearing.
What kind of regulations does the board operate under now? What kind of rules does it operate under?
That's one of the problems I understand that I don't think there's anyone here from the board. Is there, they can tell what
here's the board order.
Here's the board order.
Well, they operate under a standard set of administrative rules, or do they operate under a standard set of statutes as to making a determination?
I don't think the board, Roy, has ever adopted those in an administrative rule, have they?
Yes.
They have it in administrative rule?
WCC 8, 1978.
So Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Go ahead, George. I'm sorry.
Well,
okay. Now,
what's wrong with the administrative rules they've established? Then, I guess is the question.
Cliff?
Right.
That's what I was going to ask.
one of the problems that the was stated that if the legislature wanted uniform rating system utilizing charts, graphs, that there would need to be enabling authority to do so. The board, in adopting their rating system, felt that they could not, by rule, adopt the proposal that was prepared by Evaluation Division. Which is under Mr. Green, but this proposal was prepared before Mr. Green took over on how to rate disability. There is a pamphlet given to the members of the committee. I don't know if you have that pamphlet on rating disability. But the board stated that the courts have interpreted how they will rate disability. How they will rate, for example, unscheduled disability must be rated on loss of earning capacity only. They have taken the court's decision and said, this is our guidelines, which are very broad guidelines.
How can we usurp that?
The reason the proposal as proposed in Senate Bill 48B permits the director to utilize charts, graphs, and so forth by administrative rule, by rule adoption, which will give us a basis for the ballpark in which everybody will operate in. See, the present system is so individually subjective by each.
Well, my question is, not being an attorney and I don't understand the legal system, wouldn't you have less litigation if you were to use court precedent than you would try to fly in the face of it?
If the court precedent was spelled out clearly on how, quote, you do certain things, but they don't, as you know, and Ted will tell you that they say you rate loss of earning capacity for unscheduled. What is loss of earning? Age, also, and that's it, about six factors. It doesn't go into the nitty-gritty of which the director would like to be able to do. And as the board said in their order of adoption, I don't whether I have it here or not, but they would not have an authority to, they did not have the authority to enlarge on the decisions of the court in how to rate disability. And if this legislator wanted them to do it, they would have to have some enabling authority to do so.
Roy, what standards have you developed?
Each member of the committee has a copy of this rating guide.
Okay, that's the green book you gave out.
Green book. I would prefer that you not use the name green book because that kind of assault.
John Miller Reed's going to claim that. No, I understand. Cliff, that was basically correct.
That's correct. There's some. That is absolutely correct. As far as procedure, one of the problems too that has never been mentioned is that a lot of time, and this occurs quite frequently, is that the claimant has a right to appeal within 1 year of the determination order. The procedure and policy has been pretty much that if he appeals within that 1 year, even though he has an aggravation claim, it's still a question of extent of disability. These are other factors that are considered in the program.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Lynn.
As Senator Kulongowski just explained, 80% of those cases that go to hearing receive an increase in the award. If we were to adopt this, where a closing and evaluation looked at this, then are we saying that the person would receive a higher award up front rather than having to go through the appeals process?
No, sir.
Well, if we adopt the same schedule, wouldn't we, in essence, just be moving it from one side to the other?
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Roy.
Close the bench.
The main problem that I find with the board's guidelines are that they are so loose that it is a subjective determination. This means that there is no real equity in the law. If you're subjective liberally with worker A and you're subjective conservatively with worker B, two injuries or two impairments of the same level can easily become different awards. What the so-called, well, it's the disability rating guide, which incidentally is not an official publication, but is a compendium of all of the information that the evaluation division has been using for quite a number of years. And they put it into a book. It gives, if it's followed, it gives very close, equitable decisions as far as permanent disability is concerned. Once something of that sort is considered and then adopted, then the question of the amount of money, the award, is strictly a matter of adjusting, if you wish, the number of dollars per degree. But this will give far greater equity. In words of one syllable right now, if a worker doesn't appeal, he doesn't get his fair share. That's just the way it is. If you appeal, you're going to get more. And the way it works right now is, although you may not go to hearing, the carrier or the self-insurer will try to make a deal with you to give you 5 or 10% more, 5 to 10% of whatever it is you're asking for, a back, an arm, or a leg, in order to keep it from going to hearing, or at least to dispose of the issue. Which means that we are having increasing, continually increasing amounts of litigation. Now, if that is what we really are...
you're going to have to help me here. Attorney, when's the attorney get into the process? In the hearing process, is he in the...
At the hearing process, yes.
Not in your process?
No, sir. He, in this bill, he is in this process on reconsideration. Now, he wasn't in the process from a standpoint of being able to receive any kind of a fee, although there was provision for reconsideration, but it wasn't being used. Now, the theory of this reconsideration, so we can go all the way through it now, is that if a worker has competent medical authority, which says he has a higher impairment than what was determined prior by the evaluation division, it was the thinking that he ought to get it without having to pay an attorney to represent him to get it. In other words, if he has competent medical authority in his hand, a doctor's examination, which says he has 30% loss function of the back rather than 20% loss function of the back, he should be allowed to have it because it's a prima facie thing.
But he needs an expert on, all doctors aren't expert on what kind
no,
of...
No, that is quite true, sir.
And if, say, if he doesn't have the right kind of advice, he's not going to get the right kind of determination.
Well, normally, the question of impairment is not necessarily an award. The question of impairment is the impairment in motion and turning and flexion and contraction and things of that sort. That's... I don't believe is as serious a problem as the problem of equity among workers. As I say, currently, well, let me go back a little bit and explain the system as it was intended to work in 1977. Theoretically, if a worker found that he had greater disability than that which was indicated by an award, he would be able to go back and ask the evaluation division for reconsideration. It was inserted in that bill, and it was my fault because I did not read it carefully, that you could not have a reconsideration if you asked for a hearing. which meant that we had very few reconsiderations and an awful lot of hearings.
I'm sorry, Roy.
In 1977, the original of 1050, which was badly written, and I was involved in writing it, so I take some of the blame, was, quote, cleaned up by the board and sent back, and I did not look at it carefully, and by the time it had become a law, I found that instead of saying that you go back for reconsideration, period, that it didn't come out that way. It came out, you go back for reconsideration, but if you ask for a hearing before you ask for reconsideration, you can't have a reconsideration. We got 75 or 80 reconsiderations a month and something like 800 hearing requests a month. The theory was that if a worker had a disability and evaluation division issued an order or determination order regarding that, that if at a later date he found that he had a greater disability and had medical, competent medical evidence, a medical examination to prove it.
Prior to the hearing.
Prior to the hearing, right. That he should be able to get that award or an increased award without having an adversary proceeding. Well, it didn't work out that way. What we have asked for in here is now that we have a reconsideration and that the reconsideration include the attorneys and that the board is allowed to set not greater than a $100 fee for presenting information to the evaluation division under reconsideration. We think we'll get far more reconsiderations as a result of that. A lot of workers really don't know whether they have been properly recompensed. But if they ask for reconsideration and they feel that they have been given consideration, that has been someone has looked at their award and has determined that it is correct or should be a little higher, they are then not dissatisfied with what they got. Well, once it has gone past reconsideration in 48, it then goes to a hearing, and a worker has a year after that in which to ask for a hearing. It so happens that since the time between a request for a hearing and oftentimes the final order of hearing is something as much as 5 months, that the worker has at the time of final determination by a hearing officer, a year and 5 months lapse between the time that the original evaluation division determination order was issued. It's even larger than you talked about, Senator, because you have that period of time. He can ask for it within a period of a year. But in that, after that, there is the period of waiting until a hearing is held, which is all oftentimes 90 days. And then there's another couple of months in where the hearing referee is making his determination. So this is generally how it works. But as I say, in words of one syllable, if you don't appeal, you're not getting your fair share.
Chairman.
Yes, Senator Troll.
Yeah. A couple questions come to mind with regard to those facts. One is CNE just simply too hard-nosed so that people who need to get better awards are not getting them because of CNE practices? Or is the board too lenient, subjective, or whatever you're saying it is? And have we heard from the board on this issue?
You know, Senator Troll, that one of the interesting features is that no one from the board has been here on this issue, to my knowledge.
Well, I think we ought to hear from somebody.
I would think that that's true. Cliff, I want you to understand one other thing, and I know Mr. Green can't say this, and it's sort of self-destructive for me, and Senator Wingard was getting close to the issue. I want you to understand that the attorney fees in these hearings
are based upon 25% of the increased award that's given in excess of the award that's given by closing an evaluation. As an example, if closing an evaluation gave an original award that results in $1,000 and it's appealed and the claimant gets $2,000, the attorney gets 25% of the $1,000, not the $2,000. Recognize that under this procedure, if you push these back into closing an evaluation to make a determination order, the potential for increased awards at the hearing level decrease with closing an evaluation getting an opportunity to look at it again, and the uniform rating system, which means that the attorneys will probably be receiving less money. Now, I'm going to tell you why I'm not too upset about that, as I happen to have continually been offended by the fact that the attorney fees come out of the claimant's award. I just disagree with that policy decision. But the fact is that this system, if it passes and it functions, it would appear to me, Cliff, you correct me if I'm wrong, the practical effect of it is there's probably going to be fewer attorney fees paid. Is that correct?
In the new system.
In the new system?
In the new system.
Well, how do you feel about it?
But the important thing is whether or not the worker is being treated fairly.
That's correct. I think that's the primary issue.
Right, yeah. He gets what he deserves. He doesn't get more than he deserves. The state's not being necessarily ripped off one way or the other, but that there's equity and fairness in this thing. And it seems to me like we need to hear from the board.
No, I agree with
about
you. Senator Wingard.
You've sat, and you're an expert, more or less, in this area. How do you think the effects of this particular section, what will the effects be on the average worker? Will it be better for him, or will it be worse for him?
Senator Wingard, I am going to be extremely candid with you and to tell you what I think the concerns of this section are. Very bluntly, it's Mr. Green. I think that the concerns that most people have is that Mr. Green, by administrative rule, will establish a standard for a uniform and comprehensive rating system for disabilities, which they are concerned will be extremely restrictive. Now, if I am offending anyone, I apologize, but I think that the bottom line, that that's what they're concerned about. Now, I'm quite sure that if there was somebody else as the director establishing the standard, which they felt more comfortable with, that would be more liberal, I think you may see more support for this system. But at the present time, I think that's probably one of the major issues that people are having a difficult time accepting. I mean, Roy, if I'm wrong.
Quite correct.
I think that's the bottom line.
Unfortunately, I'm defeating my own purpose here.
No, I think that should be just pointed out, because I think that's the concern that most people have.
Well, leaving out the personalities, and let's say that the CNE operated as it should and the hearing board operated as it should, I still would like to know, you know, what the problem is. Is the CNE too hard-nosed, or is the hearing board too lenient?
In answer to Senator Wingard's exact question, I happen to believe that there should be a uniform system of rating a disability between closing an evaluation and the referees. I think everybody, if we're talking about oranges, should be looking at oranges and having the same system there. If you disagree and you think there's evidence that the person didn't take into consideration, I think that should be a hearing for that, to allow the person to do it. But it's just the standard, what I think a lot of people are concerned about, that's going to be adopted.
Chairman, answer Senator Trost. I don't believe that either premise is correct, that either the evaluation is too stringent nor the board necessarily is too liberal. The problem is that this so-called green book, and it is not of my making at all, and I want to bring that up entirely because I've been excoriated time and again about that, is nothing more than as I say, a compendium of what the evaluation division has been doing over a long period of time. But it put it down, instead of having a book of memoranda that's an inch and a half thick, they have put it into an organized guide and had it printed up. We printed 177 of them. It is not an official
publication. It is nothing more than a guide, and until it is that or something similar to it is approved statutorily, it cannot be an official thing. It is used unofficially in determining permanent disability. It's exceptionally useful, of course, in determining the scheduled disabilities. And again, if we don't use something of that sort in scheduled disabilities, you're going to have absolute inequities. In other words, unless you want to consider, and there are suggestions that we do, the effect of the loss of a finger on a worker's earning possible earning capacity, and of course the horror story would be, let's say, a painter losing part of his little finger as against a violinist, which would be an obvious diametrically opposed situation. But in any event, we need, I believe, a basic guideline which is definite in order to be able to properly and equitably administer this law. Once a guideline has been established, then I think it is up to the legislature to then establish the money involved out of this guideline. And that's another question that we should be considering.
That is a very important consideration, because is that if the legislature is dissatisfied with the guide that the director has established for determining disability and that they think it's too low, the answer to it is to increase legislatively, which we do every session, and there's a bill before us, the compensation per degree of disability. It, you know, currently it's $85 a degree. Increase it to whatever you think is commensurate with the disability. Now, it's a tough policy decision. A point I want to make, George, it's an issue that I think is extremely important, is this issue that if the courts have established this some guidelines, why do you want to change it? Why not go with that? I happen to be one of those who espoused the theory that one of the reasons the workers' compensation system is as costly as it is today has been either the inability or the unwillingness of the board at different times to establish administrative rules governing these issues. And what's happened is because we did not have the rules, the Court of Appeals repeatedly told the board that if you people don't establish guidelines for determining these issues, we're going to do it for you.
Why didn't they do it then?
I have no idea.
Why aren't they here to tell us why they didn't do it?
But I'll tell you, it's an example. You know the odd lot doctrine that we all take so much abuse over? That is not a legislative determination. That was a determination by the Court of Appeals in 1971, in my opinion, because the board at that time did not clearly define the definition of permanent total and have some guideline on it. And that's the reason why I think that you have to make a decision whether the courts are going to make these decisions and you're going to have the judges do it, or you're going to have the legislators, which we are elected to represent the people, do it. And that's why I'm unwilling to have the court make those decisions, Cliff.
If I may point out one interesting fact, for 60 years, and there's never still been, has not been a change in how do you rate disability, we've rated disability on physical impairment. The Surratt decision says, on unscheduled, you will rate on loss of earning capacity only. The dissent, Judge McAllister's dissent, pointed out, hey, we've been rating it, yet there's never been a legislative change, but the court has told us how we're going to rate loss of earning capacity. There's never been a change in the law on how to rate disability.
Now, do you and the board do it the same way when you make your determinations?
We follow the board rules, yes. But it's still, the rules are so broad because of the broad definition.
You know, the problem I have, Cliff, is the fact that I think that the court gets removed from this process, and I think that the people that are accountable are you and I and all the other members of this legislature, and even though I don't like to make the decision, because it's difficult, I think we have to do it. You ask why the board didn't do it, I'll just tell you one reason. I think that, and I've said this publicly before, I think that this idea, and Bob Kennedy and I have talked about it, of setting up a member of labor and management and the public is just absurd. I do not think that that operates in the public interest. That's my own personal opinion. And they've never been able to come together on many of these issues at that time to establish a rule. And I'll tell you, that's why 1050 came along, and they pulled the administrative function out of the board so they'd get somebody in there that would do it. And whether I disagree with Mr. Green many times, but at least I have to say he's done it.
Mr. Chairman, to my right is Jack Fullerton, who is the administrator of the evaluation division. So if you have some technical questions you want to ask about how it works and how the disability rating guide applies, you might direct them to him.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Mr. Folsom, do you now have a rating guide in effect on your side?
Well, we are now using our proposed guides that we have given you.
If this bill is enacted, do you see that as the proposed guide that will be operative in both places?
It would be that form. However, it'd have to go to public hearing to be adopted and let all sides be heard in case they wanted to change. That present guide there conforms to the present administrative rules established by the board.
Have you talked to the board members to see why it is they don't use your guide, your rating guide?
We haven't talked to them individually, no. There's been a difference of opinion in that they hear the employee and his representatives at a hearing, and this is what they base their ratings on. There's nothing in the guide that we have not used for many years.
Do they act more like a court then in hearing and making a determination on a whole lot of other factors other than just the rating?
They do. Yes, they do.
Senator Trill, the board, this suggestion was submitted to the board for their consideration. And the board said that the ORS 656726 codified chapter OR. This broad responsibility granted no power to the board to legislate a completely different approach, a formula approach to disability. If the legislator intends to go to a mechanical charts and table system, it must legislate explicitly and provide that the formula repeals and supersedes all prior holdings. This is what the board stated in their order of adoption. They did. I've looked at this proposal. This proposal, in my opinion, conforms with the existing court holdings. Notwithstanding that, the board said we don't have the authority, per se, to adopt that guideline.
Now, do they want this piece of legislation, or are they opposed to it, to do this?
I have no idea what the board's position is on any of this.
No. Do we know, Mr. Chairman?
We're going to invite the board over here probably Thursday night.
Okay. That's good.
Mr. Chairman, so we understand, I'm not criticizing the board. I'm saying that this, I believe, is what is required that the legislature do, that they come up with a distinct disability rating program. And this is an approach which I believe is
the disability rating program.
Yes.
This is the department.
Yes, and this is the, you have
this
copies
is
the vehicle
of the, for that.
Yeah, you have copies of the disability rating guide in your, that pile of stuff that we sent to you.
Let me ask Cliff, this amendment relating to the doctors, can you find a bill that could go in?
I understand.
The proposed amendments to be engrossed, Senate Bill 48. I think it's ORS 656254. This proposed amendment here.
This is the one Dr. Crothers is talking about.
I understand it's not compatible as far as Senate Bill 48. Do you have a copy of this here?
Okay. We'll look into it, Senator
Crothers, and see if we can't find a bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
I have another question about Bill 2. On page 3, talking about insurer closure of claims, and I'm wondering what kind of, if we go that route to have the insurance companies close the claims, what kind of protections are there for somebody who thinks the claim has been closed improperly? What are the protections?
The procedure is to request a determination from the evaluation division.
Okay. Now, is there anything else beyond that?
No. The director has authority over the insurance carrier. Mm-hmm. If the insurance carriers fail to follow our rules, eventually fail to follow our rules and so forth, the director has authority to penalize the insurance carrier. But this is no different than it presently is at
okay,
the present time.
Then I wonder if a lot of this opposition doesn't come down again to what Senator Kulongoski was talking about, and that's the director's credibility in terms of whether it be fair in this evaluation process and seeing that the claimant is treated fairly. And so is there any way that we can sort of guarantee that people aren't going to be closed out in order, because the argument is that the insurance companies are in the business to make money, and they really don't want to carry claims forever. They'd like to close them out. That makes sense for them to close them out. Okay. Now, how can we get a handle on that so we're fair? That's all we want to be, is fair.
Senator Kroll, I think it's a job of the department to see that their sole responsibility, one of their greatest responsibilities, to see that employee is treated fairly.
Okay.
And
there's a lot of lack of confidence that that's going to happen with this.
Well,
I want you to know that.
I think that is true. And there's you know, you have to have dependence on someone, but I think that the department would be in real trouble if they, as far as the legislators are concerned, as far as you're concerned, as far as any of the member of this committee is concerned, if we felt that at any time that an employee was treated unfairly. In fact, you probably had employees in there with a system, and the number of people that are going through the system, there are cases where they're not being treated fairly. But they call on you, and if we feel that they're not being treated fairly, we call to the attention of the department.
But I wonder how many of those people who do feel they've been treated unfairly never talk to anybody, and maybe they were treated unfairly, maybe they weren't, but they think they were. And they just go through life thinking they were. Maybe some of them were.
To somewhat allay your fears, Senator, as far as I know, and insurers have been closing claims or have been in the system now since January 1, 1966, and there have been derelictions on some of the carriers and some of the self-insurers. The first time anyone has ever called carriers in and said either you produce or you get out of the system was about 3 weeks ago when I called 6 carriers and 2 claims management firms in and said either you clean up your act or you're going to be shipped out of the system. That sounds rather unique coming from someone who comes from the system. But nevertheless, we do have a law, and whether you like the law or not, it's going to be enforced. And I feel rather altruistic as far as the system is concerned, because unfortunately I do have some amount of concern in seeing that the system works properly. If it doesn't work properly, Senator Groner will take care of a little problem that he likes to take care of. And so I'm very, I think I'm more than what most people would be in requiring that the carriers properly operate. I will be talking with a group of carriers on Thursday. Very candidly, it appears to me that all carriers, at least a great number of them, including the public carrier, are not doing the job as well as they have in the past. It's a peculiar set of facts. As far as I'm concerned, I'm talking about now the first payment.
Why do you think that's true?
I find that slowly but surely the number or the percentage of first payments that are being made within the 14-day statutory requirement is coming down. The average for all carriers was about 80% a year ago, including the state fund. It is now down to about 74%+. That's got to cease because our general level of requirement is supposed to be 90. We can understand that once in a while you're going to have a mistake. And so I'm meeting with the claim association on Thursday to line out and lay the bricks down and tell them either you produce or there's going to be some real serious problems. I firmly believe in it, and not everybody believes that I do, but I do.
You would pledge to use your office to be as diligent as you could to see that the closure of claims done by private insurance companies will be done fairly.
When I discussed this with labor, they have been against the idea of the carrier's closure all along. Initially, remember, this department, or it was called the board at that time, closed all claims, including no time loss claims, medical-only claims.
That was old SIAC.
Yeah. No, that was after January 1 of 66.
The old board closed all claims.
Yeah, and it was until 1973 that the law was changed to allow, or if you want to say require, carriers to close the no time loss claims. We have had virtually no problem with it. I'm saying that rather than having the state be in the business of managing claims, the state should be in the business of seeing that the people who are being paid to manage the claims do it right. We literally, that is the department, is in the business of managing claims. We close claims, we tell carriers and self-insurers, and I'm talking about carriers as a group, including the state fund, what they should do with a claim. And this, I don't believe, was necessarily the legislative intent when it was started. I believe they should do the job for which they're being paid, do it right, and that we should be a supervising and regulatory agency. And I don't want to have to come to this organization and say to you, I need more legislative clout or statutory clout unless I feel that it isn't within the present statute. And when I come to you to ask for these things, it is because I feel very seriously and very conscientiously that what we have currently is not going to do the job.
I take you at your word, Mr. Green. Of course, I wonder how we got here in the first place, and I do recall a testimony which indicated when we were talking about insurer closing that when we went to the two-way system, it was one of the things that Governor Hatfield insisted upon would be that the state would be involved in seeing to it about the closure of claims. Now, wasn't that the testimony? And Hatfield was governor.
I'm not familiar with that, sir.
I believe it.
Wasn't that the testimony? I'm sure it was.
It was testimony.
My memory is bad, but I think that's what somebody said here. And so I'm wondering, why did Hatfield think that was necessary?
Well, my opinion, worth, I think even Mark Hatfield could be wrong.
Right. Well, maybe he was. But maybe he had a reason. I'd like to know what that was. Anybody know?
I think the reason that he wanted to get the bill through.
Oh.
And there was a great deal of pressure by the insurance industry. You're talking about a three-way bill when they passed that.
Mm-hmm.
Great deal of pressure by the AOI and the insurance industry to push that bill through. They hired a legislator, former legislator, that to handle the job for the pressure.
private carriers.
So you think there was a compromise in order to get
that bill? There was a compromise to get that bill through.
I don't know. I don't know the history of it that well to know for sure.
Is
that your understanding? Or you don't know?
I wasn't familiar with that.
He was SIAC at that time, and as he opposed, incidentally, the three-way bill. At
that
time,
right?
Roy Green, we have a copy of a letter that he wrote. opposing the three-way bill and telling...
Elephants have long memories.
And telling the hazards of going to a three-way bill, and I appreciate that very much. I'm sorry to bring that.
Mr. Chairman, again, this question. Initially, when we drafted this bill, I considered seriously putting in a sunset clause, a two-year sunset clause. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to put in a penalty of $1,500 for unreasonably delaying or closing without permanent disability. It was explained to me that under the penalty rules as we now have them, that the director could actually make regulation, rules and regulations under the penalty laws we now have. The director could make rules and regulations which would obviate the necessity of a special penalty for claim closure. And
now, Roy,
I think that's currently is the way it's going.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I have the impression that in addition to five or six companies that write most of the business in the state, or creditable companies have been here and really are doing substantial business, there are a lot of other companies that maybe aren't fly by night, but they're sort of close to that. They're not doing very much business here. And it's sort of those companies I'm wondering about, how careful they're going to be about closing these claims and how what kind of a staff they're going to have here and you know, how well that's going to be done. Are you going to be able to watch those to see that it works?
Yes,
well?
We are. I can't speak for my successor. And obviously I'm going to have one.
Sure.
But I would say this. If I feel as strongly as I do regarding the preservation of the system, it's going to be very stringently followed. I believe that, and I think this is shared by the chairman, that if a carrier cannot operate within the rules that we have in Oregon, and we are unique in that we have all incredible number of rules, then they should not operate in Oregon. Now, some people have made statements to the effect that we should only have 20 carriers in the state. I'm not necessarily saying that. I'm saying if you can, with only a few thousand or tens of thousands, $100,000 of business in the state, still operate within our rather stringent rules, fine. But unless you do, you don't stay. And you'll find that some of the very largest of the carriers in the nation operate in Oregon but have only a very small amount of premium. There's quite a few of them that way. So they're not fly-by-night. This is the fact that they are not necessarily involved heavily in the Oregon program.
Right. We're going to say at 10:30, so we better adjourn. We appreciate it. We'll have a meeting Thursday, and if a member of the committee would like to, and we can just sit up and jawbone.
That'll be in the Senate caucus room.
Senate
and anyone can come to it. I'm just going to review the law as it is.
Okay, with this, we are adjourned.